series, but you could check it out. And I invite you to join me on Mondays at 1 p.m. for Heart of Mind right here on WBAI. We've got to make room. Coming up for Hour of the Wolf, we played Enchantment by Alchemy. Now we're going to do Nagual by Michael Hewitt. Thank you, Matt, for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us for the second time in 6 months, yay, is Cassandra Caw. That's reason enough to just stay tuned and, well, frankly, never tune out. Keep with us.
white steed and pull the rider down. For I ride on the white steed, the nearest to the town. For I was an earthly knight, they give me that renown. Oh, they will turn me in your arms to a newt or a snake, but hold me tight.
Con instead of claw, would you believe it? Okay, folks, I am sorry to tell you, and yes, Cassandra, we are on live now. Your mic isn't up, but mine is. Mine's always on. That's who I am. Yeah, I don't know that we may do a Facebook Live, but we're going to start it late because we arrived here late. Subway and people's sleeping schedules being what it is. Stop it. Stop being sorry. I'll tell you, I told you stories about how I've been late myself. Well, not having slept through a show and having slept on the show once. Okay, for those of you who were at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings last night, congratulations. You went to a wonderful event. For those of you who didn't, Sonny Moraine and Cassandra Call were both absolutely positively fabulous with three stories between the two of them. I got confused with Sonny because they, you will hear me stress that, because this woman prefers the they pronoun. And to me, I have pronoun trouble. It's got to do with pluralities, not with
bigotry.
It's not bigotry. It's not preference. If it were German, I think it would be easier because German has a male, female, and neuter pronoun. This capability is built into the German language. And while my name is Freund, my parents knew German. I did not. My brother knows it, somewhat, because they spoke it around him, but I never really picked it up from them. But it has become a thing for many people, including, and this is not, by the way, a gay thing. This is a preference thing. I know men and women who simply prefer they.
Mm-hmm.
I know a gay man who prefers he,
mm-hmm.
but wears a dress. And he
is awesome.
That's the one. Is a brilliant, wonderful writer who, if he doesn't get on this radio show sometime in the next 6 months, I am going to be very cross at him because I so admire his work. And he's such a nice, wonderful person. I take it you know. He writes under the name Cam Sparza, but it's spelled S-Z-P-A-R-A. Mm-hmm. But since I had to announce and audio edit some of his stories for Lightspeed mm-hmm. magazine, which is how I first encountered Cassandra Kaw. Because of that, I lost my train of thought. because of that, I knew how to pronounce his name. I knew his work. Yes, I'm having pronoun trouble again. I'm saying, wait, did I get it right?
You're trying, which is more than most people do.
Yeah, I guess. And it's not easy. It's really not easy for me. Last night, with Sonny Moraine there, I said, you know, somebody else asked something about Sonny Moraine's work.
Mm-hmm.
And Sonny was standing right next to me, and I said, I don't know. Ask her. And Sonny quietly, now I've known Sonny about 3 years. They have really never corrected me before. They is very easy on me. See, they is. That's where I have the problem. It should be they are, but it's not. Mm-hmm. It's they is. This is where my problems lie. And so she just very quietly, with a sweet smile, when I said she or her, she said they. Them very quietly and just put a hand kindly on my shoulder, and I looked at them and I said, oh my duck, you know. It's like I have known you for 3 years. I have had you live on my radio show, which, by the way, she will be again sometime in February. They will be here sometime in February. Somebody help me.
You can do it, Jim. We have faith
in
you.
It's going to take time. It really is. Because I'm at a certain age, and for, shall we say, 60 years. And I was never great with pronouns to begin with. But for 60 years, I've used the pronouns in a particular way. And I really don't have any trouble distinguishing people's identities and preferred mm-hmm. identities and nom de plumes. We have had on WBAI people named Thor, good friend of mine. I shared an apartment with him. I didn't know his name. He was Thor.
Huh. Like, legally?
No.
Oh, okay.
But that's all anybody knew, and why did we need to know more than that?
That's
very, very sweet, very nice guy. And many listeners know who he is. Mm-hmm. He interviewed Stephen King for me.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, he's come through with stuff. And he was a major force for a while at a well-known Apple dealer. Not an Apple store, but the next best thing, TechServe. Actually, not the next best thing, the best thing. Apple stores are the next best thing. This is independently run. So, so he's Thor. I don't have a problem with that. I know people, a very well-known person on WBAI, an on-the-air personality, Manuela Bruja, which in Portuguese is Hand of the Witch.
That's an awesome name.
Isn't it, though? And she's an awesome person. Who deserves that. And I happened to know her name, but that was only after like 20 years or something.
What did you call her before that?
Manya, which is what she is here and on WNYC. She's just Manya. And that's what more do I need to know? I know who she is. Now, if she decided to use they, then I'd have trouble. I know that she, I won't say, prefers women. She's very pro-woman, as it were, very pro-woman. That's her preference, and that's fine. But the pronoun, the names of people, I don't have a problem with it. The preferences of people, as long as they are true to themselves and their friends, I don't have any trouble with it. But I have pronoun trouble, as they say in Warner Brothers cartoons. It really has to do with plurality of they, them, their, mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm. So, I don't know. I'll get over it. But in the meantime, it takes very kind people like Sonny Moraine to not get angry, but to just correct.
Very patiently.
Which is what Kellen does, a.k.a. K.M. Sparza. You see, I have problems with his last name because he spells it S-Z-P-A-R-A, but he says Sparza, even though the Z is the second letter in his name.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah, right. He says Sparza.
Huh.
There you go. And your name isn't even Cassandra Kaw.
No, ah! It isn't. So, close enough, though.
Close enough for English. And I met a woman, at the last previous Nursef reading, who's just from China, who works with a group that does nothing but promote Chinese science fiction to the U.S. Mm-hmm. and to help China buy more properties from science fiction writers to turn into major films, because China is a very high-end but not very experienced budding film industry. Mm. And so she's working with Ken Liu and Neil Clark and I guess with John Joseph Adams and people like that. And her name is Regina. No. Her name is Kan Yu Wang. And properly would be Wang Kan Yu.
Yes. As if America does not seem to understand how Chinese names work, so.
Oh, well, it's funny. I have figured I don't have a problem with names.
Well, not you. I just meant the country in general.
Well, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I still don't know why the family name comes before. I guess it's.
Because it's family first, and the second name is usually shared among siblings. So the second name is your sibling name, and the last name is your name.
And yet, like you, she has chosen a name that's simple for Americans.
Yes, because it's a lot simpler for Americans, and we don't want to repeat ourselves all the time.
Yes. So should I go on with this? Should I ask you personal questions or move on?
You can ask me personal questions.
What is your true name?
Kaw Ju Yi.
Oh, that's so nice. And it's easy to say.
Yeah, but people have made fun of my, personal name. It's literally just tiny two-letter thing. Just two E's.
So?
Sorry. People make fun of it, so, yeah.
Not me, E. And there I just made fun of it. No, I was making fun of the situation. But Cassandra Kaw is a lovely name. How did you choose it? That's the question I really wanted to ask.
Oh, so
what is the derivation of the pseudonym?
So that's actually really interesting. My actual English name is Zoe. And this was given by, I think, my eldest aunt on my dad's side. And this is a completely different anecdote. And apparently, when I was born, my dad was so happy. He sat there outside of the delivery
room. That's all he should have been.
Sobbing. And someone comes over to him and goes, "What is your daughter's name?" And he goes, "Zoe Kaw Ju Yi." And the thing was, it was a nurse with the birth certificate. And he kept repeating. And she was like, "You want me to put all of that in her birth certificate?" "Yes, that's her name." So it was I have my English name stapled to my birth certificate when it shouldn't be a thing. But Cassandra,
I'm sorry, that's a lovely story.
Isn't it? It's the cutest thing.
It really is. It really is. I don't have a, Yeah, I don't have an issue with that. I think it's really charming.
Unfortunately, a lot of people now assume that my surname is Zoe, and I spend a lot of time explaining how that's not the case, even though it looks like that legally.
Uh-huh, right.
But Cassandra came about when I really got into mythology in my teen.
Oh, of course.
And I have always had a good instinct about people and situations, and despite that, no one ever listens to me. And I decided Cassandra was a good symbol of all of that. And the way I reason it is, even if no one ever believed the mythological Cassandra, she could probably have used all of that fortune-telling power for herself instead.
Yeah. Yeah. Although it's very funny that the idea... Now we're on Facebook Hello. Live, by the way. Oh, and you look fine on it, by the way. Let me say. If only I can adjust this tripod. There we are.
I'm always worried about angles because I have a pancake face.
Oh, stop it.
I really do.
Okay. Oh, my God. And the viewers are coming in.
I'm very concerned about that. Oh, my God.
So you're going to... Oh, no. The oh, my God is that we have viewers already and I only just clicked live.
Oh, gosh. Hello.
Hello. And they're good people, may I say. Some of them literally from around the globe.
Oh,
well, Maryland.
I can't find you on Facebook Live.
Go to my timeline, Jim Freund.
Sorry, I am very slightly vain and concerned about how I look, so.
Yeah, you mentioned that last time. I was careful with the photographs that I had taken.
I don't always like photographs of myself.
Well, what did you think of the video of you from last night?
I am slightly, almost reluctantly surprised by the fact that it looked fine.
Yes. Also, we should mention that Madeline Flieger does a very, very good job our video technician.
She really does.
She really does.
Thank you, Madeline.
Thank you, Madeline. So, and I so appreciate the work that she is doing there. And Terrence Taylor is our technical director.
He wasn't there that evening, was he?
No, he wasn't. He took the evening off because he had a cousin in town from Japan.
Ah.
And he doesn't get to see them that often. So he was going to bring them to the reading, but then he couldn't have sat there and talked with them.
Oh.
So I gave him the night off, knowing... Also, that we were taking the training wheels off of Madeline.
Madeline did an incredibly good job.
Yes, she does. Yes, she does. Oh, God. Okay, see, now I have to put on my glasses because one of the cool things, he said off mic, one of the cool things about Facebook Live is that people chat to us. It's almost like nonstop, and to each other. It's like nonstop listener calls.
I'm trying to figure out how to get onto Facebook so I can see what people are
saying. There's an app for that. You don't have the Facebook app?
I apparently do, but I don't. Sorry, people. Not technical difficulties, but certainly mental difficulties.
Yeah, also, also you will find it confusing because it's about a 15... That's good, actually, Drew, to brush the hair away. Yeah, you look good. There's about a 15-second... Yes, that's correct, Joel. Joel says, the video isn't mirror image. Does this mean that we have been receiving transmission from the mirror universe?
Yes. This is indeed the mirror universe.
Yes. No. Now we're actually not mirrored. You see, when I'm doing the show by myself, I use the front-facing camera. That goes this way so people can see my visage. But when you use the front-facing camera... That is mirror image. It always is. So because you should be able to brush your hair, if you see a mirror image, you can't adjust yourself in any way. So they always reverse it, and I don't know why they don't give you a choice. But when I'm using the rear-facing camera, which I am right now, this little thingy, I'll block it by pointing at it. There, everybody see my finger? Aren't you glad now you can get my fingerprint? When I use that camera, which is, by the way, three times the resolution.
No pressure.
This is an
No, that doesn't mean anything. The front is like a mere 6 megapixels. This camera on the back is 18. This is a darned...
It's a Pixel, right?
This is a Pixel.
I keep thinking I should get one of my own.
There's a Pixel 2 now. Which in some ways I think the Pixel is better than the Pixel 2. For example, the Pixel 2 doesn't have a headphone jack.
Oh, wait, what?
It only has Bluetooth. Same thing with the iPhones, new iPhones. They're doing away with headphone jacks. Why?
I don't know.
Sales.
That's fair, but it still sounds
terrible.
No, it's
not fair.
I mean, it's fair to the corporate entity who is trying to make more money.
I don't care about
it's the... It's a prerogative to be horrible, I suppose.
I don't care about the bleeping corporate entity. I'm an end user. I'm a buyer. Oh. I'm also a technical reviewer, if there were anybody who still had the budget for it. You're a games designer.
I am a narrative designer, I guess, games. Oh, yeah, I hinted that I was working at something.
Yes, and since then, the secret has been blown.
Yes, I am working at In Exile Entertainment as a writer on Wasteland 3.
Okay. A person from Canada asks, how does not having a jack help sales? Answer is, now you're selling Bluetooth headphones.
Yes.
And if they are white and look like the kind of headphones you have on an iPhone, they're over $150 for a pair.
However, just selling more peripherals all the time.
Yes, exactly. But on Amazon, or I shouldn't say Amazon, on a number of online vendors, you can get a perfectly decent pair of $20 over the ear. I really tell people, get over the ear, don't get earbuds. Earbuds, you turn into Peter Townsend and you go deaf. No, they're really bad for you. They're really bad for
really?
You, earbuds, yes.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Everybody does them. But, you know, read the reports. Over the ear, you know, you're not putting something blocking the air going to the ear canal. You're adjusting the volume better. You can hear ambient sound when the car runs you over. And stuff like that.
Unless you're using a noise canceling over the ear.
Right, yes. And there are those, but then you're spending very serious money.
Yeah.
And if you're doing that, why not just spend the money on a good pair of speakers at home and then just use cheap over-the-ear headphones when you go out? I do my, as you can see, everybody watching, yes, one person says, deaf I could deal with, tinnitus, not so much.
Yeah, I can definitely sympathize with that. Like, I get a smaller version of it every time I go sparring.
Yeah, which is it, earbuds irritate my ears as well, says Todd. So
Todd Mulder?
No, Todd Mason, who's a bon vivant.
A what now?
A person about science fiction. He's very well known. When I had Datlow on the program and the staff of Omni magazine about a month ago, and I said that Todd had typed in something, I said, Todd says, who? She said, who, Todd Mason? And I said, yes. She said, well, of course. So, you see, people know Todd. And he's very, very active on Facebook in various science fiction places. And Todd, you must have professional credentials, I take it. Now, you see, this, in some ways, this is cooler than listener calls.
It really is. You don't have to make room for one specific person at one specific time. Everyone can have a conversation.
And they can talk to each other. Uh-huh. They can have private chats. And they can talk to me, they can talk to you, just by typing away. And if I ever get around to getting over the fear of engineering three things at once, which I currently am, because I'm operating two computers. I have what they call a KVM switch, keyboard video monitor switch. I've got a console over there, plus the phone, and then I've got the camera phone over here. Which is doing the Facebook Live event. And that takes some monitoring. Is there only one new Omni by now? That is correct.
Yes.
There is only one issue of Omni that is out.
But hopefully there will be more.
Oh, yes. It's a quarterly magazine. There will be a future issue.
Mm.
So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is awesome. Let's talk about you for a moment. Not everybody heard the last time you were on the air. You are utterly horrifying.
What?
How many stories did you sell in 2017?
24. What are you reaching for?
Okay, all of you, that's my coffee. That's all. I'm just going, oh my God. How many people have sold, and we're not talking fanzines, we're not talking blogs, we're talking SFWA, mm-hmm. Professionally adjudicated, what's the word I'm looking for?
Certified?
Yes. Professionally certified publications, bona fide professional sales in a single year. Michael Swanwick doesn't have that, you know. Michael Swanwick, who's won more awards. Yeah, and kind of sort of the Datlow Group has the actual product. There was a typo there, product. Yes. And somebody else, in response to how many stories you sold, is just sending a lot of exclamation points. You can see all this when you go home. It's a lot of fun, actually, to follow the Facebook Live. But, yeah.
Someone told me that 12 stories was very little in 2016, and I needed to catch up.
Oh, they were pulling...
No one told me they were limb. Joking.
Barbara Krasnoff, who was Nebula nominated for the same anthology you were in, mm-hmm. Clockwork Phoenix 5, in 2017 sold one story. In 2016 sold four. And she's good.
She really is.
She really is. And I say that without any...
Personal bias?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, truly. I have to get her on the air, for God's sake.
Why isn't she on the air yet?
For fear of...
Nepotism?
For fear of looking wrong. I didn't even mention on the air for many years. But I mean, by now, let's put it this way, and she's probably forgotten. And I trust, Barbara, you're asleep now?
Oh, no.
I see her log into this every so often. She, in fact, I can take a look. Are you on Facebook at this moment, Barbara? No, but she has a number of friends who are currently watching. But anyway, what was the point I was going to make?
You're making me very embarrassed about my stories.
No. I'm supposed to be making you proud. This is a good thing. You know, the point is that, okay, let's take somebody who's been in the business for so many years. You've been there now for, what, about 3 or 4 years?
3 years.
3 years, right. And... and you've just zoomed in. Who, may I ask? Not a name, but a friend who told you that 12 stories wasn't enough.
I'm not going to name the guilty.
No. I'm not asking for a name. I'm asking for their position. Is this a friend of yours? This is an editor, another writer.
It's a friend of mine. It's another writer.
And it's another writer. Okay. A professional science fiction writer?
Yes.
Bite her. She's wrong.
Him, but...
But bite them. Going back to our earlier conversation, bite them. Slap them. Buy them a cup of coffee and make it too hot.
Oh, no.
That's good revenge. Cassandra, by the way, is a fabulous cook. But anyway, but so am I. And I have to prove it to you. But anyway, the point is that is remarkable, and they're good freaking stories. And I'm not even a fan of horror. And most of your stuff is horror.
Dark fantasy or horror.
Yeah, exactly. So the second story you read last night wasn't really horror. It was really dark fantasy.
Yes. I don't know if that was dark fantasy even. That was just very...
Angry. Yeah, it was an unhappy story. Although it really has a very exulting end, very, very positive.
It was very triumphant.
Yeah, that's the word. So not everything you write is in that realm. But the first
done a paranormal rom-com. I'm vaguely proud of that.
Oh, have you? Oh, you we. Oh, hello, Theodora. You're waving at each other virtually. Theodora, we have to get you back on the air sometime.
I love your work so much.
I love her work. I love her. She's a wonderful person. You haven't met her.
I have not.
You have to come to a ReaderCon. You have to get to the U.S. during a ReaderCon.
When is that?
That's in July.
I'm in France for a talk.
Everybody's in France. Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman are in France. I've had enough of France. Let the French come here. somebody else. Whoops. Somebody says, 12 isn't enough is all it takes to push to double that. That's talent, somebody writes. Another person says, Jim, do you consider Fritz Leiber dark fantasy? Yes. Some of his novels were marketed as such in the 90s, but was that an anachronistic given how they predate the term? Mary Shelley, who created the modern science fiction, last week being her anniversary, didn't know the term science fiction.
Huh, I never knew that.
Oh, the term science fiction was coined in the 1940s.
Oh.
The term scientifiction was coined by Hugo Gernsback, somebody, Todd, somebody please correct me. I'm going to guess in the late teens, 19-teens, something like, you know, World War I era.
Right.
And he called it scientifiction or scientifiction. But it was one word. And John W. Campbell in either Unknown Worlds or Astounding Tales of Space and Time, both of which were his, where he brought people to the genre like Robert Heinlein, Theodore Sturgeon, Ray Bradbury, got a couple of people in there. He coined science fiction.
Mm.
And then Robert Heinlein
coined
the term speculative fiction. Something people don't realize.
Really need to do a historic show.
Yes, absolutely. I want to do that. I've done a few already, but none in a long time. But that's going to happen this year somehow. Maybe with Barry Malzberg, because he knows where all the bodies are buried. and he was an agent with Scott Meredith for so long. But he doesn't like to do phone interviews or anything, and he can't drive into New York anymore. Okay, Gernsback made up science fiction for amazing. This is Todd Mason talking. And then introduced science fiction. Really? With science wonder stories and air wonder stories in 49. Now, I think Campbell had the term before 49. Correct me if I am wrong. It's about 46, 47 that Heinlein came up with speculative fiction.
I'm staying away from this battle of the historic giants.
I may have to bow to Todd because, you know, he's as much of an authority as I. But I'm not bad. I've read Brian Aldiss three times. Aldiss wrote this fabulous history of science fiction called The Billion-Year Spree. Mm. Oh, yes. Well, you're half asleep and typing. How do you think I am? I started working at 9 a.m. because I had a podcast to get out, and it was so problematic. But
it's not one of mine, is it?
No.
Okay.
No, it's... Oh, God. I had so much trouble pronouncing his name, I'm not going to do it. Really, really good writer. Jose Pablo Iarte?
I know who you're talking about. I'm not even going to
Wrote a story that goes live in a few hours on LightspeedMagazine.com with Stefan Rudnicki as the narrator. You can read it, too. But listen to Stefan reading it. I worked hard on editing that.
Okay.
And I'm the host of... I actually recorded at home. They record the stories in Hollywood. NOLA. Yes. Because that's where Stefan is. I mean, he lives within the neighborhood known as Hollywood.
That's kind of awesome to say. even if it's
if you heard, I finally got the Hollywood ones, and oh my God, it's like Times Square. You're thinking Times Square is so cool, and then you see this horrible place of pornography and filth.
I don't like LA. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, no, I'm not an LA fan either. Which tells me what song we'll play when we take a break. You all know it's going to be Randy Newman, right? typo. Skeelo, who the hell is Skeelo? Randy Newman, thank you. There we go.
Wait, actually.
Yes.
I wanted to request a song, but I don't know if you can get it off YouTube.
I don't do YouTube.
Oh.
I do something better.
It's a remix that I like very much.
Okay, tell me. I pay for a service that is not YouTube, and this is legal. And we pay ASCAP and BMI and Sound Exchange. So we are paying for all of our legal, whatever Todd Mason says. Judith Merrill picked it up and ran with it as a term for science fiction, fantasy, and more. What John Clute says, fantastica for now. Yes, I'll go along with that. Oh, I met Judith Merrill and I didn't know it.
I have a good story about Gabe Newell, who basically runs Valve and Steam.
Really? Oh, yes, well, you're working for Valve. That's the secret.
No, I'm not working for Valve. I'm working for In Exile Entertainment. They're doing Wasteland 3. It's a post-apocalyptic RPG. And I think
I like RPGs.
The first one was basically, I think, the inspiration in many ways for Fallout.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to work on the third game in the
series. I've only just begun Fallout, because actually they made it free recently on
Fallout
Steam.
Fallout New Vegas?
Fallout, the original, no, the original Fallout was for about a month during the December holidays period, was free on Steam.
I think some of the people working in Exile today actually worked on the original Fallout.
Cool.
I'm not 100% sure. Paul, if you're listening to it, our dear PR manager, I'm not making any of this fact.
Okay. I was a games reviewer, video games, and PC games reviewer for a Computer Shopper. I was the games reviewer there for a while. So I was working for Ziff Davis, so they didn't have to pay me per article. And I was happy to get all the free games in order to write the reviews. And then on this show, An Hour of the Wolf, I had a lot of the very first writers of computer games on my show, mostly people from Infocom. Mm. Now, if you know your gaming history, you know about Infocom.
I do.
Yeah, okay, so I had the fellow who wrote Zork, and Planetfall, some guy named Douglas Adams who wrote a couple of games, I think that he also wrote a radio show called Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and he wrote a TV show. He was a script writer, rather. He a script runner for a TV show called Doctor... I don't remember. Something Who. I was the first person in the U.S. to broadcast Hitchhikers.
I think some people were arguing with you about it, weren't they?
Hmm? No. Some people have what happened? I'll try to make it quick, because I've told this story in the air a lot of times. Yes, absolutely. Infocom's games claim to be novels that the reader interacted with. I never bought that. Oh, yes, the wonderful game Leather Goddesses of Phobos. That's a text adventure.
Not played that. I'm not sure if I want to play that.
Yes, you do.
Are you sure?
Yes. It's really hilarious pulp. It's really hilarious pulp, you know. Get your ray gun, but you can play anybody you want, you see. It's fun. Wait, how can I follow the plot of Hitchhiker's Guide if I can't see Warwick Davis? Well, remember that Hitchhiker's is a radio show, and Warwick Davis was not in the radio show. So there. I think it was in the movie. But before there was a movie, there was first the radio show, then there were the books, and there was a TV series, then there was a play, then there was a movie. Just so that people got this right, Hitchhikers was written for the radio.
It
was
then it became a novel.
3 years later. Mm. 3 years later, for anybody who doubts, you know, which came first. But at any rate, so I broadcast in about 1978. The TV, the novel is, I think, 80. Mm. So what happened was WBAI used to broadcast The Goon Show and other wonderful BBC programs until they decided that NPR came into being and PBS, and they had a lot more money than Pacifica Radio. So they started charging us fees that we could not pay. So we had broadcast equipment from the BBC. That's proprietary equipment. Their radio shows were sent on 14-inch LPs, which American turntables could not play. That was the idea. So this fellow named Douglas Adams gets in touch with the station manager, WBAI. Yes, any radio station has more money than Pacifica. He's right. Somebody contacted Larry Josephson and said, yes, I'd like to be on your radio station, on Pacifica Station. My name is Douglas Adams. I do this, I do that, and Larry says, what is this? And he says, well, it's a science fiction. And Larry hears the word science fiction. He says, talk to Jim Freund, okay? Just talk to Freund. So in comes this guy, Douglas Adams, whose name I know because I watched Doctor Who, which had been on in the U.S. Mm-hmm. for about a year at that point, during the Tom Baker era. And so I knew who Douglas Adams was. So I go, oh, goody, goody. And he came with this box of discs, and he said, well, this is a radio show that I've been doing off hours with the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. It's called Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and all that. And sorry to hear that you guys aren't, you know, taking BBC stuff anymore. And somehow he accidentally left those discs behind.
Accidentally, is
it? Oh, yeah, absolutely accidentally. Yeah. Uh-huh. No, Todd, I don't have those discs anymore. But yeah, that's what they were. They were standard issue in the 40s in radio transcription before tape came in. Yeah, he's exactly right. So, and they were standard largely because that's what the BBC used. They also used 10-inch discs, which couldn't play anywhere near as much. They were like 20 minutes long. No, not 20. No, like 3-4 minutes long. Well, that was when they were 78s. But this ran at 33. But so anyway, then after having left here, Douglas went and had an interview with my counterpart in L.A., a wonderful human being by the name of Mike Hodel, who used to be on Hour of the Wolf when Margot Adler was the host. I was the co-host on Thursdays and Fridays, and he was an intermittent co-host on Mondays. But then he left to become the news director of our L.A. station, KPFK. And Douglas Adams went there because he was doing this wonderful radio show called Hour 25. And this, curiously, the same thing happened. Is somehow Douglas left yet another six discs. And so this story has been told on Wikipedia, attributing it to Mike Hodel, saying, Mike Hodel premiered it. No. I beat him by 2 days. Get your facts straight, people. Two freaking days. Also, in those days, I was on, at that point, 2 days a week at 2 hours a shot, like we are tonight. And so I played them all in three shows. In two shows. Whereas Mike, who had 1 hour a week, played them over, the way they should be heard, non-binging, one episode a week. So I had finished before Mike began, but the difference is a day's difference. But same idea, same network, same premise, but Douglas came here before he got to Mike Hodel. Next round Douglas made was he was promoting his visual video game. He did a couple. He actually coded a couple of Infocom games. And they had a game called Starship Titanic, which I loved, which he co-wrote with Terry Jones of Monty Python.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he had a lot of Python voices in there. This was actually a visual game, limited visuals. And, well, it had a few breakaway scenes. So, what was the point of that? Oh, yes. And he died shortly thereafter. Oh. He went to L.A. trying to sell the movie version to Disney of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yes, Orson Scott Card. Hello, Lawrence Watt Evans, one of the great science fiction writers, is tuning in. And Joel Schlossberg says Orson Scott Card contributed to some LucasArts games. Yes, and I think he did more than just LucasArts. And by the way, I claim to be one of the first people I know to be online, because I got online first in 1981. But when I got on CompuServe in 1981, the host of the science fiction forum there was Uncle Orson. So Scott Card beat me online by a number of years.
Oh, geez.
So he's an old-timer. He really, whatever his politics are one thing, but he's a superb writer. And
a fixture of our industry.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So was Jerry Pournelle, a fixture of the industry. But Jerry was... And Orson is, Scott, I should say, is a very personable person, and he would love to argue with you reasonably.
That's
which Pournelle good? Did not.
Oh, dear.
Pournelle would get red in the face.
Oh, dear.
And start ranting and raving. And Scott, while his positions are perhaps more radical than Pournelle's, Scott's always polite. I disagree with him more than I do Pournelle, but you can talk to Scott. That counts for a lot in my book. You're still wrong, Orson. But anyway, that will get back in my no.
Could you find a song for me?
Could I find this for you? Let's see.
It's a mashup between the two artists.
And this is an iPhone?
This is not an iPhone.
Oh, no, oh, no, no. You have a droid here. Okay.
I do.
What is it? Write new message. You're in.
Look at the message section. Like, look down.
Okay.
Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah.
Attention.
Yeah.
Sam Sui and Allison Stoner.
Yeah. What does that have to?
If you're going to play a song, can I have that one?
Oh, is that the name of the song?
Yes.
Oh, okay. And is Allison Stoner the performer?
Allison Stoner and Sam Sui.
Okay. Let's just go for Allison ST. O-N-E-R, what a name. Allison Stoner. Oh, it's A-L-Y.
Oh, my bad.
It's A-L-Y is her name. Okay, and oops.
The other, oh.
And okay, your phone timed out. Hold on.
No, it has a keypad. You need to give it back.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't put a cord, a pass thing on
Sam
mine.
Sui.
Okay.
T-S-U-I.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, I have to see all her songs. And let's see. Anywhere the Youth's Home, This Boy Is Mine, Fly Away Home.
It's a collaboration between the two.
Yeah, but I'm just looking at one and should list for either. So, S-A-M-T-S-U-I.
Yes.
Okay. No, that gave me a person, which I'm sure is not the right... Hold on, let me go back. Okay, we're on Allison Stoner. A-L-Y...
What is the service that you're using that is legal, but works fine?
I'm sorry?
What is the service that you're using that is
legal? It's called Google Play Music.
Oh.
And I like it more than the others. I would say it's on a par with Spotify.
Oh.
But I like it more than the Apple alternative. And I pay the monthly fee. Mm-hmm. And so I acquire it legally. And then because we pay to broadcast songs on the air, I'm broadcasting it legally. Ooh. And how I acquire it, as long as we're paying the right people, it's totally legal. So, there. Okay, so now let me try that with Sam Tsui. I'm doing both her name and Sam Tsui. And, we may have...
I still want to come around, but I can't. I'm tethered.
Yeah, you can come around for a moment.
Oh.
You'll just be on kind of the same video of music will often be less on Google Play. Yeah, except Google Play and YouTube are the same people, I may point out. And somebody else is writing about, was I online before Arthur C. Clarke was 1981, is 3 years before the Odyssey file. Gee, I don't know. I was online starting about 1981. And I never, you know, I wasn't running in the same circles. I just used local dial-up BBSs. Yeah, there's the search thing. So you can just type in there. And you know what we're going to...
I will be perfectly happy, this one.
Oh, okay. Fine.
Thank you.
Okay, we found a song.
You will understand why, that song.
Okay, very good. Very good. And yeah, that's do it once more. Perfect. Because I know that you like to look a certain way on camera.
Which is hidden under my hair.
The first song that has an E for explicit lyrics?
Yes.
You know I can't legally broadcast that, right? Because
oh.
It has an E for explicit lyrics.
Oh.
Oh, I can broadcast it. I will broadcast it. I will just have to give a disclaimer.
Oh, okay then.
Okay.
Don't have to scare me like that.
Well, 6 months ago I couldn't. It depends on who the administration of the radio station is at a given time. The FCC, yes, somebody wrote Safe Harbor, and that is absolutely correct. This is Safe Harbor, but you see, Safe Harbor, which I helped create, Todd, with a fellow by the name of Harlan Ellison, who is as unsafe a harbor as one can sail into when it comes to his mother bleeping mouth.
Yeah.
Harlan, I broadcast his reading of the story Shatterday. And what I did, and it had every word in the world, but I played it before 6 a.m. And we got the Supreme Court to agree that between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., it was reasonable to believe that a child, an unguardianed child, would not be listening. And therefore, the First Amendment overrides guardian concerns. That's what made Safe Harbor Safe Harbor. And it was, and I broadcast it on a Friday. The next Monday, I got a pink slip from the FCC. My license would be revoked. The station would have to go back to the Supreme Court, which we already did with George Carlin, and it cost us $2 million in court fees and stuff like that. Although in a way we won that court case, but to the detriment of the station and to the benefit of everybody else in the world. And so the Safe Harbor thing was, you know, we said, well, before 6 a.m., right? So I played the Ellison thing. I recorded it on Thursday night, broadcast it on Friday morning. Monday I was suspended. Our lawyers contact Ellison, and Ellison is going, far bleeping out! He didn't say bleeping. But, you know, I'm going to go there. We're going to go to the Supreme Court.
Oh, my.
I'm going to show, you know, Justice Berger, I think was at that time, where he can stuff his robes or the sun don't shine. And we're going to get Kurt Vonnegut, and we're going to get this person and that person. And our lawyers, they loved that it was Harlan Ellison because he was like vice president of the Writers Guild of America at that point. And he was famous. And they said, do you want to, and the Department of Justice advised the Federal Communications Commission, don't pursue this. You will probably lose. B, there's a certain point at which this will be considered harassment if you bring up too many cases against them. And it never went to court. And Harlan was upset, because I, somehow personally, I cost him his day in front of the Supreme Court. He was saying, we're going to call it the Carlin Ellison case. And, oh, he was so happy that, you know, something that he wrote was going to come up to the Supreme Court, and it never did. So that's my safe harbor story. So, we knew that safe harbor exhibited.
Huh?
Somebody's saying in the mirror camera. I don't. That must have been when I turned it around, referring to me. I don't understand. It doesn't matter. We'll talk later, Joel. And if people want to know what we're going on about, we are on Facebook Live as well as on the radio. Facebook Live is different than our broadcast sound because it continues even when we're not broadcasting on the air. But why don't we play that cut of music now?
It is going to be a lot more modern, I think, than most.
Do you want to read?
I do.
You do. So probably, how long is the story going to be?
Where is my phone? Probably about 3,000 words.
Ooh, okay, that's like half an hour.
Is it?
Yep.
Oh, my. I could read very quickly.
You could, but people wouldn't enjoy it as much. And you said that last night. About that 10-minute story. Actually, I think it did clock in at about 10 minutes.
I read very quickly.
No, you did okay. You did fine with it. I liked your reading a lot. By the way, people can watch the reading. You can go to my page on Facebook.
It's 2,000 words, by the way.
2,000 words. Yes. Yeah, we'll do it. We'll play the song. We'll get right to the reading. Okay? So let me inform people, first of all, that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Cassandra Caw, fine author of dark literature. And hi, Lister.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hello.
Let me hold up. We're doing front camera because we have a guest today. So don't take off your clothes until she's done reading, okay? You think I'm joking.
He does actually take off his clothes.
Yes, you've seen that show before.
I was very slightly puzzled.
Oh, yes, but you see, now that we've got it on Facebook Live, it's a video show. I think that more people are watching Hour of the Wolf on Facebook Live in order to watch Lister strip than they are to follow, you know, anything I or Ellen Datlow or my guest next week, Chandler Klang Smith, be sure to tune in, or any of those people, have to say. I think Datlow's going to be on in 2 weeks.
Yes.
Again, because we need her to promote her Mad Hatters and March Hare's book. Mm. And she'll probably, knowing her, she'll bring a bunch of writers with her, I hope. So, but we shall see. I haven't firmed the date with her, but we did discuss it in principle. Like 4 months ago, so she's probably just waiting for me anyway. One doesn't do that to Ellen.
No. Ellen is scary. I love you, Ellen, but you're really scary.
No! She's wonderful.
She is. Also she, scary.
Yeah. To you.
Yes.
Anthony. But I work for her. I work for her online. At Omni Magazine, Omni Online, and then at, what was the name of, she had a pioneering website, one of the first websites to publish, the first website to publish science fiction, and it was way ahead of its time. You are wonderful. You are wonderful. Lister has brought us liquid.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So we're going to play a piece of music now, and Lister will be delighted to hear the words that this program contains frank language. And if you're offended by frank language, please tune out. And, does your story have any explicit?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, rejoin us at 3 a.m., at which point Lister will have Frank Language on his show. But he'll get into trouble, and I won't, by having done this announcement. So tune in at 3. So if you want to register a complaint, you register it. Tune in at 5 a.m. if you're offended by Frank Language. And for now, we are going to take a 3-minute break.
Now I'm out here looking like revenge, feeling like a 10, the best I ever been. And yeah, I know how bad it must hurt to see me like this, but it gets worse. Now you're out here looking like regret, ain't too proud to beg, second chance you'll never get. And yeah, I know how bad it must hurt to see me like this, but it gets worse. Now payback is a bad bitch, and baby, I'm the baddest. You fucking with a savage. Can't have this, can't have this. And it'd be nice for me to take it easy on ya, but nah.
Wasn't me. The song ended that way. But this does continue to be WBAI in New York City. The listener responds, I did the whole thing before. It's WBAI New York. That's enough for now. I'm Jim Freund. With me, Cassandra Call. Lister has joined us, getting ready for Burn Baby Burn Clapper, coming to these same airwaves in a mere 45 minutes. But we're going to spend... Yeah. And we're going to spend some of that 45 minutes... I was just remembering that was a point that some friends of yours, as a matter of fact, we were in the front room, in the green room, when Lister went on the air and he started playing music. And they just started not just hand dancing, they were boogieing and all that. It was so much fun. They almost didn't let me go home because they were dancing to the whole opening sequence of his show. And I can understand that, but it was fun to watch. And I was amused and cross at the same time. The song isn't the Never Ending Story, theme song? No. Oh, that was awful. Giorgio Moroder. Remember that name?
No.
Oh, yes, he does. Because Lister was a record producer, and so was Giorgio Moroder. Lister was with Island Records. Giorgio Moroder was a major force in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And he actually did a very interesting, I won't say good, but a very interesting job with the movie Metropolis, hiring Queen to do much of the soundtrack for the silent film. And it was very controversial, but I liked it because the only other version that was known was like 90 minutes long, and Moroder got sources and built it up to be almost 2 hours with missing clips. And then he did little things. It was still black and white, but if there was like a little bauble in the background bubbling, he'd make it yellow. So there would be just one little thing in the silent black and white movie, just a minor thing in the background that might be colored. Jacques Tati did the same thing in his Jour de Fête. So it's actually an old style thing. And they would have tinted the movie live in theaters in 1927 anyway. Mm-hmm. But then they would have tinted the whole screen. And now they have an almost 3-hour version of Metropolis, still one of the best science fiction films ever made. We're coming up, by the way, in about 3 months to the 50th anniversary of the best science fiction film ever, ever, ever made. You know what that is.
Don't look at me that way.
Yeah, you're a youngster. It's the 50th anniversary, so it's before you were born. 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, I haven't even watched that. I should fix that.
Yeah, you should fix that. And you should do it in the right circumstances. I mean, it's one thing when you're watching Star Wars and you're missing, like, you know, I'm talking about the one movie that was actually called Star Wars, which they later retitled to A New Hope. The original movie is just called Star Wars. And the first time that Imperial Destroyer goes over your head, I was like, wow. But 2001 A Space Odyssey in Cinerama, which was a curved screen, thin and curved, and in the big, big screen, so that it was totally immersive and all that. Even today, on a decent TV screen, you can come over and watch it with Barbara and me and other people. It is still the gold standard of science fiction cinema. Often copied, never duplicated. Some people have done very good variants on it, like Solaris by Andrei Tarkovsky, and not movies that everybody knows. How many languages do you have? Five. Wow. Yeah. Same as my father had 5 languages. So so he was a bit of a polyglot. But yeah, how many languages are generally spoken in Malaysia?
Everyone speaks at least 2 languages. Most of us speak about 3.
So they would be what? Thai?
No.
Malay?
Malay, English, and depending on your ethnicity, Tamil, Hokkien, Cantonese.
Mm.
It varies.
And the food, I am told, is magnificent.
It really is.
Americans go there just to revel in the flavors coming in from all the countries.
I'm not entirely certain about it. Most Americans come there to have food poisoning.
Now, you came here and got food poisoning.
I did. It was terrible takeout, and I was taken out for about a week and a half.
Oh.
I'm never having Chinese takeout in America again.
No, you just have to go to the right place. Again, we think Wohop. It's actually in Chinatown. Also, there are some very good places in Sunset Park in Brooklyn and in Flushing in Queens.
My cousin has been insisting on dragging me off to Flushing, so I'll trust him on that.
Trust him on that. I've met him. He looks like a person. That's the person who was at the reading last night.
Yes.
He looks like a person. He looks like a person who would know his Asian food. And very nice fellow. Very nice fellow.
He really is.
Soft-spoken, but very nice.
He is also more impressive. Hi, Alan, if you're listening to this in the morning, understand I'm about to embarrass you. he's very humble about it, but he is a double gold medalist in, I think, Shaolin Kung Fu.
Whoa!
He did Wing Chun, he did Judo, Tai Chi.
And you do...
I do Muay Thai.
Yeah.
But yeah, he can use everything from chain whips to short swords to, like, pole staff and shit like that.
And that's for people he likes.
Yeah, yeah. People he doesn't like, it gets really bad.
Then that I don't want to know about. I would be delighted to share stories of Chinese cuisine, but I'm sure that he knows better than to take you, especially in Flushing. Flushing Chinatown is like this Blade Runner kind of universe of neon.
I love it. Yes, I have. I lived in New York for a while there.
Yeah, and now we're developing the same kind of a thing in Brooklyn, in Sunset Park, which has just exploded with people with wonderful food. And there's like this place, it's like a little hole in the wall entrance, and you go in and you discover you're in this 5-block underground paradise with pulled noodle markets and a supermarket. I will never go in that supermarket. I will never buy their fish. I will never buy their toads, which are just sitting there piled one on top of each other looking very sad, very sad, very sad toads. But they are cool. Hey, June, how are you? A friend of mine, a good friend of mine who I haven't seen in how many years, June? 20 years?
Oh, geez.
Yeah. I've seen her brother more recently. But not June. Not since, like, the BAI Crafts Fair or something like that. I think it's time for... we can just yap, or you can read.
I like this story. It is from an anthology called 2084, and it was organized by a small press in London. They invited a number of science fiction writers to, you know, reimagine 1984, except in a more futuristic context. So for background on this story, I've done tech journalism for about a decade now or so. And one of the things that I discovered that was extremely interesting while I was writing it, and even before, is how easy it is to manipulate video, audio, visuals. And as much as people say, as long as, you know, you have video proof, I will trust it, it's surprisingly easy to manipulate.
Oh, yes. The truth. And audio, I can speak firsthand. Mm. I can make people say things that they never said, you know, and not just chopping out a word. I can build words.
And while this was written under very different circumstances, the general sentiment in this story reflects some of my recent circumstances, which I'm not going to talk about on radio, but which Jim knows.
And I'll talk all about it next week.
Yes.
When Chandler comes here, she and I will. You met Chandler last night.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. But
yeah, so this story deals with technology and how it can be manipulated, and how the truth of the human heart will not change regardless of what you do. Degrees of elision. Observe. A man stooped over a table, cigarette drooping from the edge of a downturned lip. He exhales. Carcinogens and nanites, recent biohistory, lung performance, circumstantially acceptable, vascular integrity, good, dopamine saturation, minimal, requires action. The smoke tendrils diagonally into a vent. In the background, music, jazz from the 50s, alleyway wisdom told in saxophone and bass, pruned of course. Of inflammatory content. Frame shift. The table is a screen, gel-based. His fingers leave ripples in the plasma. The interface is nostalgic, recalling the two-column architecture of old newspapers. Light emission savaged the strong jaw, the cheekbones cut sharp as a government suit. Make him gaunt, strange, and hungry. Pull back. We see his office. Cubicle, really. Four walls, slate black, no ornamentation except for the carcass of a succulent in the corner, leaves shriveled to brown. A backpack hangs like a corpse from a hook on the door. Huh. His voice, a chorus tenor, ill-used, not pleasant, but also not unpleasant. We see the silhouette of fingers steepling, a spine uncurled. Observe. His face hallowed in neon. Observe. His fingers long, pleasingly shaped, skating across the screen, pulling up windows. His touch grazes a word, accept. Text is gorgeous onto the panel. We see him lean forward. The camera follows, static. A recording begins. Now listen. Her voice, female, gorgeous, an erotic contralto laced with something of the French. Not much, enough. Too much and it risks becoming overpowering, unctuous, tawdry. She propositions him with a duty, moans the last line. We trust you know what to do. He does. History is reams of data points, each the sum of a billion snap decisions and considered actions, sustained by narrative, stitched together by those who survived. In eras past, society believed it was also inviolate, every recorded viewpoint sacrosanct. We know this is a lie now. There is no singular truth, no fact that cannot be altered, repositioned, and resold to the world. This is what men like him do. They change the world. Observe. There can be symphonic music, Wagner maybe, something dark, moody. The man lights a fresh cigarette, this one contraband, only tobacco and sweet clove. Breathes in, breathes out. He takes it slow. This is not an action scene. Smoke tangles between his fingers as he navigates between conversations, looking for commonalities, places where an idea can be applied, removed. Subtlety is integral. Novices gouge at the past, leave it wounded, vulnerable to suspicion. But men like him, they understand restraint. He finishes, grunts. Satisfaction trilling in the lower registers, borderline sexual. This is his best work yet. The man rises, hits send, spares a moment to contemplate the woman in the recording, wonders if she had been flirting with him. He does not recognize the voice, but the department is colossal. He has not spoken to everyone. Maybe it's the new girl in services. The one with the painted-on skirt, the blowjob lips. Could be her. She always has a smile for him, doesn't she? Brushstroke lashes over blue eyes, mouth slightly agape, tongue wet. The man presses down on his erection, warns it to secrecy. He's married. Conjecture is not felonious. But he knows his spouse would disagree, would suffer umbrage at the notion he'd entertained fantasies of her on his mouth, a stranger on his cock, his world remade into sex and skin and salt. He goes out. The lights follow, 1 minute and 48 seconds after. You're late. Her voice, quiet, sweet. Slightly nasal, but not unpleasantly so. Work. Reply. Wrote. He shrugs off the backpack, lets it drop where he stands, and pours himself into the couch. Their apartment is government issue, white on white utilitarian furniture, mid-century inspired, sleek. He would never admit it to her, but he loves it, loves the austerity, its implications of character. His wife, slender despite 3 pregnancies, wild-haired, crosses the room, folds herself into the chair opposite. We need to talk. No, we don't. We've been I know. But this still bothers me a lot. His wife pulls a knee to her chest, knuckles going white. We've spoken about this. I've said I'm sorry, and he lifts hands, spreads them. I don't know what you want me to do. What happened in the past, I can't change that, and we were on a break. She flinches, full body. Her reply is acidic. Yes, and all bets were off, and we could do anything we wanted during that time. But don't you think you should have had the courtesy to tell me? I didn't ask you for any information from that time, did I? Response, tone even. And you didn't supply anything either. What I do value is our present. I didn't do anything that needed to be explained. Neither did I. Her jaw twitches, a contraction of muscles, like a finger squeezing the trigger. It fires off a light in her eyes, rage. Couldn't you have told me I was a colleague of yours? Would I have changed anything? She meant nothing, means even less now, a flash of teeth. I don't know what to do with you. She leaves, doesn't explain why. His analysis software posit nothing of value. He considers replacing them, even canceling his subscription entirely. What's the point of keeping things as they are if they don't do what you're meant to do, Angel? Door slams hard. The man sits, face in palms. He says nothing. Observe. It's late. 3 in the morning. The sky is indigo black. No constellations. A haze of orange wicks from the streets. The city never sleeps. Frame shift. We see the shot through a window framed by tree boughs. A large bed. A figure on one end tangled in white sheets. The man's wife. She's awake. The door opens, creaks on its hinges, exposes the man's gaunt silhouette. He hesitates. Almost retreats when she turns and props herself up on an elbow, hair gleaming turquoise in the city light. Come here. He complies, coils into the sheets, leg curling over hers. His grip is possessive, his voice bruised. He aches and he aches and he aches. I'm sorry. I know you are. I know, baby, I know. Pull back. It has been hours. Teal suffuses the horizon, cinematic. A few birds shriek welcome to the dawn. The man is asleep, arm draped over his wife, hand on her pelvis. She is not. Observe. The man at his desk. His shirt is rumpled. The top button is undone. This is not an easy assignment. Today, he's rewriting the living. Listen. Recordings garbled a single voice layered over itself, slightly out of sync. A politician's voice, deep. Old. The noise resolves into a single speech, impassioned, a call to arms. It is not rehearsed. It quakes with emotion. He means this. But it is not acceptable. Dripping light from his fingertips, the man maps, phrases phonation, text to audio, checks, rechecks, checks again for every opportunity to minimize modification. He has decided. The original monologue stays, mostly. A line here, a line there, omitted or restructured, shortened, stretched, strung with nothing words, so there is space for suspicion. Pitch and phrasing, demand changes too. Those are vital. Hours pass. Then, listen. He plays the new recording. Conviction has become fiction, a salesman's solo. Briefly, regret palpates his chest. The man thinks, this one could have changed the world. But he has his orders, his salaried task. Besides, if the minister had meant what he said, if he had truly believed, there would be no room for misinterpretation. Observe. The man clutching his worldview. Observe. The frown that pits his brow, brackets his mouth in fine lines, all ages first vanguard, observe. The breath that convulses in the hollow of his throat. The tremor that says, I do not believe. Observe. The man does not flee. He walks. Shreds. Let's arrogance winnow his misgivings to dust, to nothing, to specks of memory, molecules small, too small to matter, like a handful of weekends spent with a girl who never mattered at all. This is a flashback. We know this because of a sepia overlay, the camera haze that transforms every plane of skin, turns every face poreless, unreal. This is meant to invoke nostalgia. Observe. A beach. Stars in the sky, too many to itemize. It is cold here, the breeze dragging salt scent from the north. The man and the girl sit at the periphery of a campfire. Their friends smile. They understand. Observe. Their fingers coil together, patterns of want. I thought you were interested in, you know. She's young, too young. And so beautiful in this moment, tawny-skinned and dark-eyed. Her hair burns copper in the firelight. There was a mistake. The man drinks the sight of her, the brandy gold lines of her legs, her face. She is close enough to kiss. He leans in. I know what I want. Her smile is so bright, it hurts. Do you love me? His answer is immediate. No. We return to the present. The man is mapping his apartment in frantic strides. The lights are dim. It is too late, too quiet, too empty. His wife is gone. The epiphany develops in increments, in bursts, glass edge sawing slowly between his ribs. Shock becomes grief. His wife is gone. The man makes circuits through every room, rifles through drawers, looks beneath beds. He leafs through her books, hoping to augur an explanation or note penciled in the margins, anything to say why. His wife is gone. The thought pounds like a hangover. It is too massive to cup in his skull, so he spools from him and sobs. His wife is gone. The man weeps. Listen. Where is my wife? The girl's voice, glacial, sibilant with spite. Nice to hear from you, too. First call in 10 months and you're already making demands. I don't have any time for this. I need you to tell me if you've seen my wife. Last week we had coffee. Why? He strangles the question. What did you tell her? Defensive. I didn't tell her anything. She asked questions. I answered. He chokes the words down, squeezes them until they snap. I don't understand. What part? The fact that your ex-fling and your wife might get along, or that women talk. I ended things with you cleanly. There was never any confusion as to what was going on between us. I told you that. You didn't tell me you were married because it didn't matter. Slam. The man beats a fist onto the table. We were separated. There was an agreement between us. We acknowledged the possibility of casual sex with people outside of marriage. That's how breaks work. For all intents and purposes, I was a single man and you were a single woman, and her voice is a hiss. I fell in love with you anyway. You knew that. You had to have known that. It isn't my fault you couldn't read the signals then. And it's not my fault that she has my memory cache. Slam. The line is dead. Observe. The man in his office, pale, hunched, his bones laser cut sharp. A stubble infests his cheeks, his jaws. He has not shaved in days. Observe. Light drooling from the spider bones of his hands, cresting his nails. He digs into databanks, surveillance footage, phone conversations. Everything and anything he can find. Observe. The man, he breathes deep, recites a throwaway conversation for the fifth time, adjusts timbre, changes pitch, elides that misguided fauna's pheromone driven so far from the truth. Observe. The man, dissecting a photograph, he blurs her face, twists the set of his limbs, makes them into strangers, a lunch into a coincidence. Observe. The man cutting into a video, splicing it with another, observed, "The man will not give up. Truth is subjective, reality interpreted with degrees of elation. All he needs to do is find the right one. All he has to do is show her and she will come back. She has to, she needs to." Observe. The man turning a page. He plunges on.
This song is called "Said to you when you called me 11 o'clock on a Friday morning to tell me that at 1 o'clock Friday afternoon you're going to leave your office, go downstairs, hail a cab to go out to the airport to catch a plane to go skiing in the Alps for 2 weeks. Not that I wanted to go with you. I wasn't able to leave town. I'm not a very good skier. I couldn't expect you to pay my way, but after going out with you for 3 years, I don't like surprises." And it's subtitled "A Musical Apology." In this song, I attempt to take back everything I said while standing in a phone booth on the corner of 49th and 3rd. I didn't mean it when I said I hope the cable in the elevator snaps when you step on board. And I was joking when I said I hope you crack your head and get mangled by the downstairs revolving doors. And I was kidding when I said I hope the number 103 bus hits and makes a pancake out of you. I'm sorry, but isn't it amazing what a woman in love will do? And I really don't want to see your taxi on the 59th Street Bridge flip over and crash through the rail. And I'd feel bad if at the airport you were mistaken for a local sex offender, arrested, beaten up and thrown in jail. I really don't want to see you getting radiation poisoning from the metal detector that all passengers on foreign and domestic flights must walk through. I'm sorry, forgive me for all the mean things I said to you. You thought I didn't have a temper. Ha, 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 surprise. But I really don't want to see dismembered by the marijuana sniffing dogs when a simple little nipping would suffice. And I'm sorry that I said I hope the plane explodes in midair as it carries you away from me. And I'm sorry that I said I hope you break both legs on the mountain while you ski. And I'm sorry for all the nasty things I said about your mother, even though we both know they're true. I'm sorry, forgive me. I'm swallowing my pride. I'd feel so guilty if you died. Oh, I'm sorry, but I'm still mad at you.
The amazing, the wonderful, the miraculous Christine Lavin. Ask for her by name. She's got over a dozen albums out by now. I gave her her radio debut.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and Vin Scalza on WNEW-FM on his wonderful show, Idiot's Delight. He's the one who made her famous. But I like to think, and Vinny, if you can hear this, let me know, or Chris, if you're listening, if that's not right, if he didn't find you because you were on, not Hour of the Wolf, I was doing a 7 to 9 a.m. show, filling in for David Rothenberg, and I brought her on the air, so.
Awesome.
And she is awesome. She is brilliant. She writes serious songs as wonderful as
slightly lesser songs,
like especially the one about Pluto and being demarked from being a planet and things like that. But with songs like, you know, "It's a Good Thing He Can't Read My Mind" and but some beautiful songs as well, the kind of love you never recover from. And on the other hand, a song, I prefer to make love through artificial means. And, of course, it has a problem with, you know, battery outage. So that's Christine Lavin, L-A-V-I-N. And before that, Cassandra Kaw, K-H-A-W, what was the name of that story?
Degrees of Elysium. I can't say
the Elysium. Word.
Elysium, damn it.
I always thought it was Elysium, but then Jennifer Marie Brissett, who will be reading at the next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, wrote a novel called Elysium that I got to produce the audio book for. So that's how I found out, is as doing it, and I call up and say, because I had to.
Word, though. It's a different word.
Oh, I'm sorry. How do you spell?
E-L-I-S-I-O-N.
E-L-I-S-I-O-N. I don't know that one. I know Elysium as in the fields, the Greek fields.
Not that.
Okay. E-L-I-S-I-O-N. Mm-hmm. That's a new word for me. That's my word of the day, and the day has barely begun. Do you want to take calls if we have any? If you wish to call up and speak with Cassandra Kaw, and you promise to be on topic, the telephone number here at WBAI is 347-335-0818. And also, you can type in suggestions, requests, whatever, on Facebook Live, if I can read them. I moved the camera. Oh, now it's at a worse angle, now that you're over there. You see, I changed angles. And then, oh, yes, we lost the feed in the middle of everything. We lost the feed because the Wi-Fi here sucks.
Oh, no.
And if the Wi-Fi wavers at all, it just throws everybody off and resumes the live feed when it gets a good signal again, which in this case was about 60 seconds later. So we'll now have two feeds, but we'll see. If I can keep the video from this camera, which is just a phone, then we can do it. And let's see. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Oh, gosh. There is a caller. Hello.
Good morning, all. Happy New Year, belatedly, James, Cassandra. Just haven't gotten back from the UK, so. Cassandra, lovely story.
Thank you.
You mentioned your Malay heritage.
Malay.
I'm fascinated.
Malay, yes.
Malay.
Yeah, it's not a Malay. It's,
I don't
know.
No,
I know, James.
I have a Malay heritage. I have battle axes. And
Anyway, Cassandra, I'm impressed. You said you told James you speak five languages.
Correct.
English, Malay, Cantonese. You said Tamil is in Tamil Nadu.
I don't speak Tamil personally, but I speak Hokkien, I speak Mandarin, I speak Cantonese, I speak English, I speak Malay. I no longer count these in my languages, but I used to speak Swedish and Japanese, possibly.
Wow, I'm impressed.
And she travels.
Maybe you can recommend some ethnic cuisine to James. I love... You know, just
She doesn't recommend. She, on Christmas Day, cooked a meal for me and came through the worst bleeping weather. And I was hoping that she would come over and sit with Barbara and I and stay and watch movies and all that. But then she had to run out. And as it was, we had your wonderful, wonderful pork, suga pork.
And the
fabulous mushroom bourguignon with porcini mushrooms and all that, had it the next day. So, you know, other people can recommend restaurants. She cooks.
She cooks. Well, you're making me hungry, James.
And she can cook. There's a song like that.
Yes. Cassandra, I'm just, by the way, a lovely being named for a goddess. It's too bad they didn't believe her. I hope they believe you in all that you say. Do any of your stories reflect the Malay? Have you ever done any stories based in, or in part Malay culture?
I am Malaysian, not Malay, just to clarify that.
Malaysian culture.
Yes, the Rupert Wong books are completely enmeshed.
Yeah, we haven't even mentioned your novels.
Yes, so Rupert Wong, Cannibal Chef, was the first novella. There's a collected edition of everything called Food of the Gods.
Uh-huh.
And it sees an ex-triad chef and seneschal to the Ten Chinese Hills running around and getting to trouble everywhere from Kuala Lumpur to London.
Oh, I do love it. When you were growing up, did you ever hear stories of the wonderful, heroic mouse deer known as Kanchil?
San Kanchil, yes.
San Kanchil? Oh, I love it all. Well, listen, continued good success to you in the new year. And
thank you.
One other thing, James. Science fiction and folklore were 100 years apart the first uses. Folklore came in 1846 because of William Toms, an English literary critic. The science fiction, and you said it once on the air, 1946.
No, speculative fiction was 1946.
Speculative fiction. I thought it was science fiction.
No, science fiction was January 1st. The literature was January 1st, 1818, 100 years and a week ago.
Mary Shelley, yes.
Yeah, that was her name, right, yes.
Yes. Which,
Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley, never heard of her.
And by the way, thank you to Max for playing two versions of Frankenstein on Sunday night.
Yes, that was, I'll take credit for that.
Good. Congratulations.
Because he was going to, I asked him for one and then didn't have time for it because last week I had an interview with a biographer of Mary Shelley instead. And we're going to be doing that as a theme all year. But not just Mary Shelley, but the history of the last 200 years of science fiction using Mary Shelley as the mother of it all, who spawned it, and a lot about the history of science fiction. But Mary Shelley will always be there beaming down upon us as we do these shows. I promise at least one a month throughout 2018.
Thank you very much, and to you both, good morning and Happy New Year.
New Year and happy Skiffy anniversary. you would know. We've got like 3 minutes left, or 4 minutes actually. Time flying as you tap away there. People are trying to call up your ISFDB entry and post it on Facebook.
What?
Yeah,
on Twitter recently.
Yeah, well, they're talking about it on Facebook.
Oh God, why'd they call?
I don't know. They're trying to get to it and worried about a spam detection filter.
Oh.
So they can't help but love. Yeah, they're looking up your. We haven't given enough of your bio. Tell us what your novels are. Your collection of short stories.
Oh God, I have a lot of short stories.
You're collecting. You have one coming out, don't you?
I do not.
Ooh.
I've already been courted by several publishers about that.
Yeah. Todd Mason says, huh, I was posting it and it was blocking. Oh, I wonder if Facebook is blocking it.
Possible.
Ooh, yeah. Facebook does stuff like that. So.
But, yes.
So you have to say it.
Oh, God. So I write the person's non-grata series. And the first book, Hammers on Bone, is basically Lovecraftian noir in Croydon. That's about as much as I'm going to give away.
Right.
And the second one is, I guess, Lovecraftian Southern Gothic set in the Jim Crow era. They are tonally incredibly different, but they follow the idea that the worst horrors are not the ones that we associate with eldritch monsters, but things that are closer to home. Rupert Wong, Cannibal Chef, and all of the following books associated with him is a lot more gratuitous. It is definitely splatterpunk. In the first book, somebody was very disappointed that there was not a lot of people cooking. So I opened the second book
despite the word cannibals in the title. Yeah.
So I opened the second book
It's a cookbook! Sorry, that was something.
I opened the second book. The first chapter was basically Master Chef with Rupert Wong desperately trying to prepare a porn star for the consumption of ghouls. And it has stopped people from making the mistake of purchasing it. If that is not your speed, it's very gory. It is very high octane.
It wouldn't be my personal first. No.
And the last book that I have out is from Small Publishers, the book Smugglers. It is a paranormal rom-com featuring a fashionista, bisexual werebear, her vampire roommate, her love triangle.
That old trope?
Her love triangle with a billionaire fae, a werewolf, and a lovely woman. It has no gore, no awfulness. It's bright and it's frothy. And
I'm there. I'm and there.
At least one person.
That should be a movie or a TV thing.
At least one person has bought that book, decided they loved my work, then purchased Rupert Wong.
And found something a little different.
They were all different. I don't know who this person is, but I respect them for going, huh, I guess she writes different things normally.
Yes, how about that? And The Food of the Gods, which one is that?
Food of the Gods is the compilation of the Rupert Wong novellas.
Ah, okay. Yes, and that was reviewed, one might point out, in the New York Times by frequent Hourly Wolf guest Nora Jemison and N.K. Jemison. She writes too.
She does. She writes the most amazing things. I think her books are coming to TV now.
Yes. Not the Broken Earth series, the Inheritance series. Somebody wants to know what the GGA award is.
Oh, the German Game Awards.
Oh, that figures. That figures. Very cool.
I wrote a small indie puzzle game called She Remembered Caterpillars, and we won Best Children's Game.
Yeah. Whoa! We're out of time.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Bye. Yeah, I know. It's pretty, like, awful. And, Lister, you're going to have to bear with me for about 1 minute running over. Not a whole lot, but, yeah. But I, with no offense, I was more interested in Cassandra than I was in whatever else. So you're here for a couple of months, and then when are you coming back?
I will let you know after I do my tour of Europe, so to speak.
Okay. And because we want you back, and if nothing else, do you Skype?
I do.
Well, we can have you on via Skype.
Awesome.
Yeah, awesome. It's cool. So, again, Cassandra Kaw, ask for her by name, K-H-A-W.
There is only one other Cassandra Kaw in the world, and if you get it wrong, she will exasperately forward all your emails to me.
Oh, okay. So, again, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for last night. And people can watch last night's performance on live stream, or I have links to it on actually Cassandra's timeline, as well as my own timeline. And
watch that one. It's the first and only time you'll ever see me look so glamorous for anything.
Oh, that was a nice outfit. Yeah, the one you wore in September weren't bad. And good health to Brooke Bolander, who Cassandra's filling in for. She got the flu. And I had noticed. I wasn't going to say that. You had it a week earlier, and then, well, yeah. And it was all just so that you could become the reader again twice in one season. Well, we were happy to have you and give our love to Bo.
I shall.
Okay. Everybody, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper coming your way. And the disclaimer will probably still be in place. Take care, and your clothes are still on, Lister. Okay, I'll have to keep the Facebook Live going for a minute. Good morning, everybody, and please, everybody, be good to each other.
Flag. I'm only doing and party.
'99 Sink a List Alive. Tune to Radio Station WBAI, 99.5 FM, New York, WBAI.RJ. Flagburn in time, make it 8 minutes after 3 o'clock. We do this right after Jim Freund. He'll be here next week, same place, same time. Burn the red, white, and blue to ashes before 5 o'clock, y'all. Thank you.
Feel me feel when deal me dealing, da da do.